How does one make sure that they don't fall in love too much within the idea that they think is brilliant?
So I think that's what made me realize it was when I was really pushing just the idea that I believed in, I was able to achieve this amount.
On the innovation piece, how you guys actually implement technology. But yeah, in terms of like ideating around that.
That's one of the best advice I can give your listeners is to one, that innovation is an outcome. It's not an input. You can't force innovation to occur.
Where does innovation start?
I think it starts with finding a of what it is. I think it's hard to move the needle on anything that you don't have shared alignment around.
How did our guest today go from co-founding and exiting his construction tech startup to chief innovation officer at Rogers O'Brien Construction? We are absolutely honored and excited to welcome Todd Wynn on Bricks and Bytes. Todd's journey is a masterclass in curiosity, perseverance, and a relentless pursuit of a better way. In this episode, we discuss Todd's methods for implementing innovation at Rogers O'Brien, where construction tech doesn't quite move the needle and what we can do about it, and Todd's learnings from selling his business and becoming one of construction's most influential leaders. If you're enjoying our podcast, you can support us by heading over to www.bricksbytes.show and signing up to our newsletter. This is an easy and free way which helps us keep the podcast going. In addition, you'll receive all of the key insights from the guests we have on, as well as some bonus content about what's going on in the wider world of construction tech. And now, an announcement from our sponsors. This episode is brought to you by Shift, helping contractors like you leverage BIM to secure a leading position in the race towards construction's digital future. Visit makethesht.digital for more. This episode is brought to you by Build Vision, transforming construction supply chain by bringing contractors, manufacturers, and stakeholders onto a single software platform. Visit buildvision.io to find out more. Todd, you have a rich history in construction tech and innovation. So just to reel off your CV a little bit here. So you were the co-founder of Project Atlas, which was subsequently acquired by Bluebeam. You then moved to Bluebeam and you were the VP of Strategy and Partnerships. You had various roles at Rogers O'Brien, where you are now. And now you're Chief Innovation Officer. We'll go into a little bit about this, but focusing on Project Atlas, could you just tell us a little bit about that acquisition? Because I'm guessing that was quite a substantial part of your career so far.
Yeah, that was definitely a bucket list check I had to check at some point in my life, is be able to take an idea across the finish line. And so Project Atlas was a solution that was actually entrepreneured at Rogers O'Brien. It was one of many ideas that we had. And it was one that the industry received a little differently when I talked about it on stage. And so we ended up doing something about it, raising some funds, hiring developers, and essentially creating, we like to call it Google Maps for construction. What we did was we geo-referenced the project information to real-world coordinates so that you could essentially navigate your project's information by location.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Okay, we'll jump into that a little bit later. But your role now, Chief Innovation Officer at Rogers O'Brien. So what does it mean? How did it happen?
Yeah, chief nerd, Owen. Chief nerd of construction.
I prefer that one.
No, I'm just a super passionate guy. It's been a lifelong mission to discover a better way how to build. So in this role at RO, when it was established, I actually oversee six departments at the company. So IT, VDC, quality, operational excellence, field engineering, which is interesting, and R&D.
Very nice.
Yeah. So part of that is just my I'm the champion of trying to discover a better way on how to build for the organization. And I have some amazing people that I get to work with every day. And that's our simple mission within the innovation group, is how we structure it. And that mission is just to discover a better way.
Mm-hmm. On your background, so how did it feel to become co-founder of a startup and then going back to Rogers O'Brien? So from the founder to employee, what's your experience on this?
Yeah, that's a great question, Martin. I think what was great about it was I got to see a little bit of behind the curtain on the vendor provider, solution provider side. And gosh, there were a lot of insights that I never even was aware of. I'll tell you some were positive, some were negative. One of the negatives, I think those are the ones that the listeners are going to be real excited about. What was the bad? It was realizing how much these solution providers don't understand how construction works. And that was mind-blowing to me, because so many of these solution providers have built their entire companies around solving our problems and our needs. But, you know, it's a lot different in an office or in a room with whiteboards than in the trenches on a pan deck pouring concrete when it's a 120 degrees Fahrenheit. I don't know what that is in Celsius, but it's hot. That was one insight that was really interesting to me, was I don't want to brush this with one broad stroke that solution providers don't understand our business, but I think there's a huge opportunity for them to build a greater empathy and understanding of what it is we actually do and the problems we face. That was one that I didn't realize how big the knowledge gap was until I was on that side. And then when I came back, I mean, I definitely was equipped with some new negotiation tactics with these solution providers as well.
Mm-hmm. Was your co-founder also from construction?
Yeah, Joe Williams, who needs to be named, because, you know, in life, there's two types of people. There's dreamers and then there's engineers. And we need both to move society forward. Like, that's why it's always great to watch a sci-fi movie to see what the dreamers are saying. This is where we're headed. But then there's an engineer sitting in the audience saying, well, this is how we could make that work. And Joe was definitely the engineer co-founder. I was the dreamer, the idealist, and he really was the one who said, well, this is how we could make that happen. And Joe had a background of architecture. He was a structural engineer, even worked for the Corps of Engineers, so on the owner side. So he, of the AECO, he really represented the A, the E, and the O, and I was the C. So I come from the construction operations side. I started in the trenches building buildings, but I always like to say that I was also the guy in college modding his Xbox to beat his friends at Halo and find that competitive advantage. So it was a match made in heaven between me and Joe whenever we put the AECO together and the dreamer and the engineer as co-founders.
Yeah, sounds like a good combination. Okay, let's dive in then. So we're going to cover a bit about innovation and then implementation and how you guys do it at RO, and then we'll get into the juice of the acquisition of Project Atlas. So from your perspective, Todd, and at Rogers O'Brien, which we may shorten to RO for the benefit of our listeners.
That's what we call it.
Okay, cool. Where does innovation start?
Yeah, I think it starts with finding a common definition of what it is. I think it's hard to move the needle on anything that you don't have shared alignment around, hey, what do we even mean by this? So the first thing that we do at RO is we actually create clarity and alignment around the definition of innovation. And for us, innovation is nothing more than a better way. And that's why it's one of our core values at RO. So we believe that there is always a better way. It's just currently obscured by our own lack of understanding. And what that does is it drives us to be more of a learning culture. So that's the first step, is to understand that innovation, I think nowadays we get hung up that innovation is this shiny new tool, this shiny new object. It's in digital form. No, innovation is just finding a better way to arrive at the desired outcome that you're after. And it could be just a change in process in, you know, something that took 5 steps now takes 4. That's a better way. That was innovative. So it's first building kind of just some common understanding of what we mean by innovation. And I'll pause there if you have any questions around that, because then I'll get into what the next steps are.
For me, I was gonna ask about a better way. Does it mean in cost reduction? Quicker, or even perhaps better for the environment?
Totally. That's the beauty of it, Owen, is that innovation is about finding a better way to arrive at your desired outcome. So if your desired outcome is to build more sustainably, or to build with a higher level of quality, or to build safer, or to build with more effectiveness, then those are your desired outcomes. And then we then have to start becoming curious in how we can discover a better way at doing whatever that goal or objective is. So we put a lot of focus and investment around alignment of what is it that we're really trying to achieve? What is our MIT? We call that our most important thing. And then let's obsess around how we solve that problem. That's one thing you're going to hear from me a lot on this is don't be obsessed with the solutions, be obsessed with the problems. And that's that is an input to creating the output of innovation. Mm-hmm.
We've heard that from actually quite a lot of people who are at similar position at focusing on the problem, not on the solution. So my question on innovation with an organization like Rogers O'Brien, for example, is does it come from top to the bottom or from the bottom up? And how do you see it? What's effective way of implementing innovation? Or where does it come from usually?
Yeah, that's a great question, Martin. And I get that question all the time, especially with people who are trying to be more innovative within their firms. They're like, hey, I'm not getting it from top down. I'm pushing it from here. And you can do bottom up. It's tough. It's really hard. At RO, we're very blessed that it's actually top down. So Justin McAfee, our third generation owner, his grandfather was Pat O'Brien, the namesake of the company. And Pat recently was walking the halls up until 2019 is when we lost him. He did a lot of work early on with Texas Instruments and who do the computer chips that are in all of our phones and calculators. And that's where he was really impacted by total quality management, Lean, Six Sigma, Toyota manufacturing methodology back in the early 70s and 80s. So that point, it became kind of interwoven into the DNA of RO is that, hey, we're going to lean into trying to discover a better way. So then it became top down for many years. But that doesn't mean that if you sit in a company to where you're not getting it top down, you can't create an impact with the resources that you do have available to you. You can. It is more challenging, but it's possible.
Yeah. How does it work then? So someone at the top says, we want to use a sexy new reality capture software. Go and do it.
Yeah. So the first thing we say is the first thing we do is and gosh, I hate to be the cliche, like I'm going to be throwing out lots of books and different mindsets and authors. But, we start with why, Simon Sinek. Why do you want us to use that, Owen? That's where we would start, because it goes back to keeping our eye on the ball of what are we trying to solve with this? We're not looking to invest in technology just for investing in technology's sake. We're looking to solve the company's problems and our company strategy. I can't tell you how many times other CIOs will come to me and say, what's your innovation roadmap look like? Well, our innovation roadmap is our company roadmap. They're not two separate things. Mm-hmm. And it's because we utilize innovation to arrive at our company's objectives sooner. That's
what it is for. Yeah.
Yes, that's what it's for. That's why it exists. Yeah. So if we had something you picked one of my favorite topics, because I think reality capture is actually going to be one of the most, probably one of the largest opportunities over the next 5 to 10 years to be able to objectively capture where we're winning and losing on a project in a passive way. Right now, we inspect with eyes and fingers, and we have to be We have to geographically insert ourselves. That's just a fancy way for saying we got to go walk the job, and we got to go and actually put our eyes on the project to be able to assess risk, to assess where we are winning, where we're losing. And I think that with reality capture, we're going to be able to capture a lot more of that passively. So that's something we're investing in right now. So the first thing we do is we define what's the problem. And a problem around that is our subject matter experts, our best builders, cannot be everywhere at once on the project. So how do we empower them and augment their knowledge with more of an understanding of what's happening on the project where? That would be the problem, Owen, that this solution could potentially help us solve. So once again, grounding in the problem, grounding in what we're trying to achieve, and not falling in love with our solutions. Because I'll tell you right now, and the listeners, I have screwed up many times in falling in love with an idea and a solution. And we'll even get into some of that with Atlas, because I messed up with Atlas in a couple areas where I was too in love with the idea of what would be in a perfect world. And we don't at times really look at what reality is willing to consume and willing to adopt. Mm-hmm. And we have to bridge. Yeah. Yeah. You got to bridge between reality and that perfect ideal world.
Question to it. Thought, how did you find out that you were in love, too much perhaps in love with the idea? Did someone tell you, or do you manage to calibrate yourself within the on the appropriate path?
You know, that's a really good question, Martin. I it wasn't someone told it to me, because I thought I was delivering the automobile when people were looking for faster horses, right?
Make sure that they don't fall in love too much within the idea they think is brilliant, yeah. But they need to validate it with some sort of checklist or someone else.
I think it was through experimentation. I think it was realizing whenever I fell in love with the problem more, I had better success. So I think that's what made me realize it was, wait a second, when I was really pushing just the idea that I believed in, I was able to achieve this amount of success. But when I was able to revisit a problem and look at solutions as more hypotheses that need to be validated or invalidated, I had way more success at being able to advance in a scalable way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the innovation piece, so you mentioned that you start with why. I suppose like that. So what I want to try and understand this part is what happens before it then goes actually live onto site. Because in the adoption part, we'll talk about the like how you guys actually implement technology. But
yes. Yeah,
in terms of like ideating around that, is there something that happens after the why?
Yeah, I mean, there's something that happens even before we're looking specific to our tactics around how we're even evaluating something. And that is, and I hope I don't get too touchy-feely on you guys, but the point is, it's mindset. Mindset and attitude precedes everything. And if you can really shape the right mindset on how to influence inputs to more innovative outcomes, that's one of the best advice I can give your listeners is to, one, recognize that innovation is an outcome. It's not an input. You can't force innovation to occur. If you even think about it, we don't know if something's innovative until we're looking in the rearview mirror. It's always after the fact and that's why, listen to how we even describe things are innovative. We go, that was innovative. And we're saying it in the past tense. So if that's the case, then we have to then start discovering, okay, well, then what are the inputs? Because that's where we can invest. That's where we can put our focus. And that's what I've been discovering over the last decade in my career is that there are very specific inputs that then will help flow this output of innovation. And if you want to know what those inputs are, I can run through them, a couple of them real quick.
Yeah, I think that would be good to understand how you guys do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, the first one that I always talk about is curiosity. Like first you have to believe that a better way exists before you'll ever uncover one. So curiosity is one of the most powerful inputs to creating an innovative culture. And by the way, RO is not innovative because of me. It's not innovative because of a department. It's innovative because it's interwoven into the mindset and attitudes of all employees. And it starts with teaching them to be curious. It then teaches them to have courage. Sometimes you got to be the first one dancing when no one else is. Like, you got to have courage to try something. Yeah, Martin, you got it. And then all of a sudden, other people are like, hey, this is a better way. I'm going to dance too. And then there's the diversity of perspective. Don't innovate in a bubble. Like, when I throw an idea out there, you're going to have a different perspective, Martin. You're going to have a different perspective, Owen. And that exponentially amplifies our opportunity at uncovering a better way. And then be obsessed with learning. I mean, the truest statement I can give you is, if you want an innovative culture, you have to have a learning culture. Because the most innovative people in the world, the most innovative companies in the world are the ones that learn the fastest. Mm-hmm. Then we see the outputs of innovation they create. So, and then the last one I always throw out is keep it fun and light. We actually, whenever we're having fun and doing great things, we have more courage to throw out the crazy ideas that sometimes are the right kind of crazy.
Mm-hmm. So when you recognize like there's a problem, like it could be, you can't track progress, for example, or like you keep getting screwed because rework and think or whatever it is. So someone at top level would be like, oh, this is costing us. Is it normally cost driven? And you, someone's like, oh, and then you go, okay, here are some solutions for that problem.
Like, yeah.
How does that look?
Yeah, absolutely. It's cost driven. But I think that there's many elements to that, because one thing we really focus on is the leading indicators that then cost a lot of times is a lagging indicator, right? It's one of those things where when you're measuring it, there's no longer an ability to influence that final bottom line measurement. So some of the inputs or the leading indicators to that is like, Are we increasing the effectiveness of our people in that area? And that those are the areas where we'll go focus to innovate. And then we know by investing in these leading indicators, we know that we'll have more predictability in the lagging. So it's not saying, okay, this cost us a ton. Like I'll give you an example. I'll give you a vulnerable example. At Rogers O'Brien, the projects that we've analyzed over the last 5 years that have not gone well, 60% of those were schedule related. So that then was a great data-informed insight that has now made us start to say, okay, well, we need to optimize or do better in the way we do scheduling at RO. So we're using that to inform where we place bets. And the reason why I like to call them bets is because they're not provably correct. Mm-hmm. It's our beliefs. It's where we think that if we focus here, it's going to have a lagging result over here. So that's where we've even innovated our org structure around scheduling. Scheduling now lives under my domain. We've pulled it out of operations, and we're even creating new people and processes around that we hope will have a positive lagging result over the coming years. That's just one example.
Okay, yeah, cool. At what point then do you decide to adopt the technology and say like, okay, yeah, we recognize the problem, it's scheduling, we got to do something about this. Is the instant thought in your head like, we need a piece of software, or is it actually, can we do something else?
Yeah, so I've been developing this framework. I call it the OPTIMA framework, OPTIMA. It's an acronym, and I'd be happy to share it with you. I have a really cool graphic on it. Nice. And you
it's
always
the one
hear
in the background, is it?
Yeah, that's it.
We can't read it though from here.
Oh, it's too small. Well, it's funny because I teach it constantly to our people. And what's great about this framework is I can send you the graphic though, so you can put it on the screen or whatever.
That would be cool.
But you always hear people talk about people, process, tools, right? Mm-hmm. Well, there's more to it than just that. And that's what I want to take you through is my learnings, at least. And by the way, none of this is, once again, this is just Todd's opinion. So take it for what it's worth. But I've screwed up a lot, guys. So it's worth a listen.
People love it when people screw up, by the way.
Right?
No one wants to hear the positive stuff. So spill.
Yeah. Well, that's,
I guess it's
that's
a learning curve, right? And everyone appreciates
that's
and
it.
What to learn from.
Yeah. Well, and I love, I think it was, I can't remember who said it actually now that I say it, but it was, we never lose. We either win or we learn. Yes. I mean, the price, the price of being innovative is failure. That's the price of entry to ride the roller coaster. So be ready if you're listening. That's why you have to be obsessed with learning, because failure is the best learning technique we have. So with the Optima framework, what it is, the O stands for objective. What are we trying to achieve? Like, a lot of times we really just go straight to, we need a new hammer. We need a new hammer. And this new tool is that new hammer, this shiny new tool that it's saying it's going to solve all our problems. But let's get back to just checking the box, doing a simple check-in. What's our objective? Once you have your objective, you can then move to the P in Optima, which is people. Okay, well, who are the people that are actually going to be assigned to champion and lead the solving of this objective? And there's some things you need to be looking at there. Do they have the capacity? Do they have the capability? You know, it's funny how I'm about to do a little offshoot here. We all want to achieve results, right? Well, there's a very simple mathematical formula for results. Clarity plus focus times time. That's it.
Yeah.
If you can be clear and focused on something over a period of time, you will move the needle. Mm-hmm. And that's where we overlook that. We say, hey, we need to get this shiny new tool. And then we don't empower anyone to actually have the capacity of focus to actually drive it across the finish line. That's where I see a lot of companies fail with implementations, because it's always an added responsibility to someone that is already underwater with the role that they're in. So you have to have that investment in time of around the people that are going to solve the objective. Mm-hmm. And then you move to the T in Optima. And T for me stands for targeted outcomes. These are, we don't want to take a shotgun shot. We want to take a rifle shot of how are we going to know if we're actually achieving our objective. If you've ever heard of OKRs, the OKR methodology from John Doerr, used by Google, Netflix, Amazon, they have what are called key results. Well, targeted outcomes are the same thing. It's just key results let you know how you've arrived at achieving your objective. And what's so important, and I see so many companies overlook, is they might take the time to say, here's our objective. Then they assign someone to it, and that person knows it. But when that person builds their tiger team or task force or peer group that's going to work on this, they all don't take the time to align around what does winning actually look like with this. And I mean, lock yourself in a room with a whiteboard and paint the canvas of what done looks like. Because that right there is one of your most critical moments to be able to activate these individuals when they leave the room to all be rowing together. And I don't mean just rowing east. I mean on degree heading 256. Because if one guy's on 256 and one girl's on 250, well, guess what? Over time, they're going diverge. To diverge. We overlook the importance of alignment. I'm going to just pause there for a second if you have a question, and then I'll keep going through the Optima.
Yeah.
No, I think carry on going.
Okay. So once you get targeted outcomes and everyone's like in the room going, heck yeah, I know what winning looks like. I know how we'll know that we've arrived at achieving our objective. Now you get to look at integrated processes. So what processes are we going to use that actually are going to help us achieve? A lot of people put tool above process, but a process is the parent to tools, right? Tools are used within a process structure. So you could say with this team, okay, well, we're going to spin up a Microsoft Teams channel to be able to collaborate. That's one process. Another process is we're going to meet bi-weekly on this and have a cadence so we can track. Another process is we're going to have a scoreboard so we can measure versus our targeted outcomes on where we are winning and where we're losing. And then you could say, oh, and by the way, we're going to need a reality capture tool for this. So now you get to go down to tools. And this is where what I call modern tools in Optima. That's why it starts with an M. So modern tools, because you don't want to be using an old hammer. You want to make sure that you're finding the best new tool for the process, the integrated process that's going to help you achieve those targeted outcomes with those people to achieve the overarching objective. So now we can get to tools. I can't tell you guys how many times I have someone, even in RO, who will say, hey, we need a new tool for this. And all I'll ask them is, well, can we go back and check these boxes first?
Yeah.
Because if we can, and that's the beauty of it, guys, if you can check those boxes, then you can feel even more empowered that we're on the right track to find the best tool for this.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. I feel like this, because what you just said is this about this new tool. And like, hang on a second, we need to go back to basics, like why do we need it, etc. So like this feedback part of it, I think it's absolutely crucial and important in any type of business. If you think that you're going to do something, then okay, but who is going there to challenge you? And like, maybe it's a better, different option that you could choose from.
The beauty of using Optima is it prevents you from falling in love with the tools or the process. What you're in love with is the objective. What are we trying to achieve? And making sure that everything that we're solving in the other parts of the framework are recursively influencing the greatest outcome in that objective and those targeted outcomes. Mm-hmm. And then the last variable, the last is A of Optima, which stands for accurate measurement. You got to measure if what you've put in place is actually moving the needle on that objective at the top. And that's where it becomes essentially a feedback loop. And what's cool about the accurate measurement place is we can put things in measurement that are measuring the tools capabilities, the processes capabilities, the people, and are they all activated and engaged to the level they need to be? You get to measure across the Optima framework, and it then becomes this feedback loop to where you could go, you know what? I don't think our process is correct at this moment. We need to actually come back together as our little steering committee or tiger team and revisit that part of the Optima framework.
Brilliant.
Yeah, I'm personally interested in some of the tools. I think a lot of our listeners will be founders and people building these tools. So, could you maybe tell us, like, from the tool part, a solution that you guys have adopted maybe recently, and what does that company do well? Like, why was that the solution that you decided to go for?
Yeah, definitely. Well, our tech stack, it's so interesting too. And I have a cool slide on this where it shows kind of the timetable of the application footprint at RO. And if you look at it from over a decade ago, I mean, it was like, Timberline and Excel and the US Postal Service, right? Like that's how we were communicating like submittals and things. But then about 10 years ago, there was this explosion of point solutions. And that, so we ballooned with all these tools, and now we're actually in this mode of tech debt consolidation. We're trying to actually, because we want to streamline the accessibility of that data. This is where it starts tying into our data strategy, our process strategy, and then, you know, what people are wanting to talk about, our AI strategy. But specific, to answer your question, you asked for a specific tool. I mean, we recently adopted Procore Financials. So we've been a Procore company for some time now from the project management standpoint, but we rolled out Procore Financials 2 years ago. We finished the implementation last year because, as you know, it's a lot of projects that are migrating, a lot of people, a lot of change management. That one was a big one for us because, and the reason we went with that was because it aligned to our data strategy. And it was the ability to create the promise of the feedback loop all the way to estimating and to have accessibility of that data. Our previous system did not give us that capability of easy access and easy data manipulation. So that's the main driver of that. And then that wasn't the only driver. It actually, a big driver for us, y'all might laugh, but does it make our people's lives easier? I mean, that's a huge one for us.
Yeah, makes it. I'm going to ask one more. Sorry, Martin. I know I've led this, but I just...
No, you're fine.
...on this point. Someone comes to you with a solution, like you realize you have the problem. Someone comes to you a solution. What puts you off? Like, why do you go, oh, you know what? That's not for us, or there's a better solution out there. Like, what puts you off?
Yeah. That's, and you know, it's funny in my position, I come across a lot of solutions, right? And
I was going to also ask that, but I felt bad because there'd be more questions.
Well, let me give you some data on that real quick, and I'll come back to answer that question. I used to get solicited to, just 3 years ago, probably, I don't know, 7 to 10 times a week. Now it's 7 to 10 times a day.
Wow.
Literally.
Wow.
I mean, it's at the point now
What stage are these?
A variety. I mean, heavy on the startup side, just because of the VC funds that have entered the industry in the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. So heavy. I mean, I would say 80% are in the startup phase. And guys, it's so tough for me because I've been where they are. Yeah, so I want to think forward, right? I want to at least have a call with them, give them some advice, even if we're not going to go with it. But I can't. I just can't. I won't get anything
Send
done.
Send them to us.
So I will. Yeah, absolutely. I will send them to y'all. But no, I think that, you know, the other problem is, and I battle this because there's always something I can learn from an employee who's coming to me saying, hey, I think we should try this solution. Even if we've evaluated it, and I it'd be real easy for me, Owen, to go, hey, we looked at that. It doesn't work. It's vaporware, right? They're selling something that they're not solving. But that's not a great approach because that actually creates a culture of I'm converging on their idea and they're coming to say, I want to be a part of solving this problem. So I've had to actually change my tactics just because I want our people to feel empowered to be able to say, here's a new idea I think we should try. So the first step now that I do, because I bet people who are listening deal with this all the time. They'll get sent an idea and then they're expected to take it and run with it. And the thing is, I said it at the beginning, the enemy of a great idea is 5 good ideas. For you to be successful as an innovator, you have to ruthlessly prioritize. And I mean ruthlessly. You have to, no is my first answer always. But what I've done with the individuals is I've actually began to activate them. I'll say, do you have interest in actually doing some evaluation with this? Do you have interest in spearheading a tiger team around this? And if they do, then I try to activate that in some form. And if it has legs, it'll keep going. If it doesn't, it'll naturally go away.
Yeah. Okay. Is it hard to, I don't know if it's possible to even answer the question so directly, because like you say, there's such a plethora of solutions that there probably isn't one singular reason which is common across all solutions that you're like, no, we wouldn't adopt them because of this. Okay. Maybe timing comes into it.
It really goes back to, and this is why it's so important to obsess around your problems as a company, is because that's why. So here's the greatest thing I can. It's funny. I think I've said that a couple times now. Here's another thing that would be powerful for me to help your listeners with is this single question. If everything remains the same at your company, what's the one thing that y'all could do that would have the largest impact? And get in a room with your people and have that discussion. And do a little March Madness, like write a couple on the board and then put them head to head. And I promise you, you can get it down to one. Even though you're going to come up with 10, you then need to ruthlessly put them head to head and say, you know what? But wait, if everything remained the same as today, what's the one thing that would have the largest impact if we solve that? That, you, when you answer that, that becomes your MIT. That's your most important thing. And that's where you then should start. Now you've filtered all that noise of all these startups and point solutions. You filtered it significantly because you're attacking a problem and evaluating the landscape for which of these solutions should we evaluate that can solve this problem. Whereas I see a lot of companies, they're just looking at the whole landscape and going, well, this could help us. This could help us. This could. You're literally going to drown in evaluation. You're going to drown in implementation. You're not going to move the needle on anything. You're going to fall into an analysis paralysis.
Yeah.
Todd, sure. So the question is, what type of decisions are made before or questions have to be asked at the top before you make a decision that, okay, we want to be part of the Procore. And because these are completely changing the way you work and the way the organization works. So what type of questions one has to ask before they make such a important decision, decisions within the business?
Yeah. Well, so now you're hitting on the most difficult part of my job and really the C-suite at RO. So there's three of us in the C-suite, the CEO, the CFO, and me. And what we do is our responsibility is, if you think of it like, imagine like a big dam, okay, with a flood valve. We can turn this wheel and open up this level of disruption, okay? Like, change is disruption in any company. And when you're introducing a change, you have to weigh how much can we disrupt that gets us to our objective without unbalancing the organization. And that is a really, really tough thing to get good at. I would not say we've mastered it. I'd say it's a constant practice, but because every single change is a disruption to your business, to your people. But we also know that success is the accumulation of progress, and progress can't occur without the slightest bit of change. Mm-hmm. Think about that for a second. You can't have progress without change, and success or achieving your objective comes with the accumulation of progress. So we know that change is needed. We know that when we're having discussions around, hey, do we want to roll out Procore financials? This is going to come at a huge cost to disruption in the business. But the idea is that we're placing a bet on something that is going to provide more value and a bigger return on that investment of that disruption. And then depending, you said sometimes it takes months or years. It depends on what the process or tool or innovation is. It could be something very small that we could turn on overnight in the background and people can just start using, like an IT magical feature or something. Or it could be something to where on the extreme other side where we're having to change people's habits. Mm-hmm. And that is the hardest part of every single listener's job is, and the best advice I can tell you on this, sorry if I'm going down a tangent with this, but this is important. It took me years to learn that you can't change people. It's impossible to change people, but you can change something. Mm-hmm. You can change their environment. And we're all products of our environment. So as innovators, if you can begin to invest in ways to shape the environment for people to make that choice of change, to make that decision to change a habit, that's where you're going to find your success. Mm-hmm.
How do you know that a change is needed? Is it like looking companies like yours, do they look at the competition that, okay, what these guys are implementing, we want to catch up, or what's the driver of thinking?
Yeah, no, it's not our competition for us. We treat it like a golf game. We're playing our own game of golf. We're not looking at the other competitors. It really goes back to like that example I gave you around 60% of the project write-downs in the last 5 years were due to schedule. We're looking internally saying, hey, we want to be the premier builder of Texas. If everything remained the same, what's the one thing that if we focused on, it would inch us closer to our mission and purpose? And that becomes the focus, the radical focus of, okay, we need to implement change around this.
Very good. Okay, I want to just touch on some implementation, and then we'll go on to some of your acquisition highlights. Like, there is obviously a cost associated with innovation and implementation of technology. Without boring people to the details, but construction is competitive. I don't know if it's the same over in the US, actually, but over here we're all bidding to win a project. And as soon as you add a piece of technology, that increases your overhead by, say, 1%. Suddenly, you're not competitive for the job anymore. So I'm interested to hear, Todd, your experience with that and how you tackle that.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, for, decades now, our industry has driven our fees down to just razor thin margins. And because of that, it makes it really challenging to purchase new technology. And that's why I want to emphasize that you can create innovation in your organization without huge costs if you're shaping the mindsets of your people. Like there are ways to actually increase efficiency and effectiveness that don't come at a significant, now they still come at a cost because you have to go spend time with them or you have to go do that training and pull them away from what they could be working on. But there are ways that you could be doing it with very little. The other thing is partnering with some of these companies, some of these startups, they have VC funding and they're just looking for opportunities to partner with someone to have some sweat equity to be able to give them a constant feedback loop. We've done a lot of that at RO to where we'll go in and say, hey, you don't have the product in a product fit yet, but we have job sites that we're willing to carve out some capacity to learn alongside you. And with that, we want a good deal when you do find product market fit that we can afford. So you can wheel and deal in this industry in very innovative ways that save costs. But at the end of the day, Owen, you're spot on. I mean, our software costs have been rising significantly over the last 10 years. And that's why it's so imperative that we're not just adding, we're also divesting from old processes and old technologies that no longer serve a purpose. Yeah. That what got us here isn't going to get us there. So
yeah.
So
I got very strong opinions on this. That's like you said, that the software cost is increasing like year on year. I just can't understand it because the technology should be deflationary for the industry across all industries, right? And this should the technology should be driving the cost towards zero, obviously never to zero, but towards zero. So how is this happening that the costs are rising? And like, oh, an example that you gave that the contractor becomes non-competitive because they purchased some software. It just, the software should be actually reducing some other costs rather than just increasing the cost of the project. So it's just completely, I don't get it. Like, it shouldn't be this way.
No, you're spot on, Martin. I think that we're literally at that tipping point. Like right now, here's what's happened. You have all these point solutions that are essentially chasing their investor tails, going in circles. And that's where, if you know who their true customer is, it's not us, it's their cap table. That's who their customer is. And the problem is these point solutions are pricing themselves as platforms and they're not, they're point solutions. So we're at this point now where I do see a lot of companies that are saying we've invested so much, we're still running into the same problems we've always had. Are these new tools even worth it?
Yeah, waste of time.
And it's because, they're a waste of time. They're a waste of money. And they are because here's the biggest thing I believe. I don't think they're being used. Mm-hmm. And it's because the companies thought that buying the new hammer was going to fix their problem, but it's changing the habits of their culture and their people that embrace the tool to do more. That's where the value comes from.
Kaboom. This is where VC should be putting their money in the innovation departments and the people using this technology.
Yeah, it's a very good point.
Yes.
Because you can have great technology, but if it's not used as it should be, then it seems like it requires investment in human resources also, not only in the technology. This is an interesting point, actually.
That's it, Martin. The whole thing is, you know why whenever and here's the craziest thing that's happening right now that startup founders need to know, because it's not the same landscape it was 10 years ago. When I did my startup, it was about, hey, do you have a way to solve a problem at 2x or 3x than the way we're doing it right now? That's not the only evaluation criteria anymore. Now the evaluation criteria for me in the position I'm in when a solution's coming, I'm looking at what will the organizational change management costs be? What does it align with our data strategy and our streamlining of tech stack? if it doesn't have integration and open APIs. And because here's the thing, the promise now is that we can leverage data to actually learn how to build better. So we might be able to, it's kind of like Africa didn't lay down the landlines, they went straight to cell phones. So there's opportunity to leapfrog some of point solutions with the promise of data, AI, augmenting knowledge in our workforce, and automating the three Ds, dull, dirty, and dangerous. That we're going to be able to leverage technology in ways that leapfrog some of the old point solutions. So if I'm speaking to the founders, don't just come with your pitch deck that says, we can do this process two times better, three times faster. It's got to also say, here's how it fits within your data strategy. And here are ways that we're going to assist you in changing the habits of your people.
Very interesting point.
Brilliant. Yeah, people should be focused on innovation departments and customer retention as well.
Yes, Owen. In organizational change manager. What's funny, guys, is I started as a technologist, and now I'm a culture guru. I'm trying to learn how I'm learning sociology and psychology, because the tool isn't the challenge. The process isn't the challenge. Getting people to change their habits is the challenge. Mm-hmm.
If we could just snip that last 5 minutes and put that on our website, we could just get rid of everything. So, construction tech 101. Here it is.
That's it. Yeah.
Okay. Maybe one more on this, and then we'll go into Project Atlas.
There was one question that I was going to ask. So headcount versus revenue. And we touched on it a little bit. Do you think...
You picked that one? You picked that one?
Yes, because I like the money part. So headcount versus revenue. So you can obviously grow the business in terms of the headcount, but it has to have a reflection in the revenue, and obviously then top line, then bottom line, profitability, etc. So is the technology part of this equation? Is technology increasing the net revenue? We actually just said that not necessarily. It's a little bit more complex. But have you got any other thoughts on this?
Yeah, a ton of thoughts. I think a couple things. One, it has to augment and supplement the workforce, just because of the skilled labor shortage we all know is happening right now. So I think technology serves a greater purpose than just effectiveness and efficiency. I think it actually is going to be filling the void of actual productivity, which is a whole nother way of looking at leveraging technology. I mean, we always looked at it as efficiency gains and effectiveness gains. I think we're going to have to look at it through a different lens. Because I'm not sure how bad you are feeling it in England right now, but I can tell you right now, you walk an RO job site, and what you'll see from our trade partners, our subcontractors, you'll see a 65-year-old foreman with six apprentices falling behind. Like it, this isn't, it's not a body shortage. We're not missing people. We're missing skills.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge that, we're going to have to knowledge augment a younger workforce with technology, because all of our builders, if you think about our industry, guys, our entire industry, it's an experience driven industry. All decisions are experience based. That's why we attribute the best builders with age. Like yes. the old guy knows the most, and it's because they've built this constructopedia in their head of knowledge. But now we can augment that knowledge to the workforce, which will then, Martin, bring us back full circle to your question of these technologies and solutions absolutely have to allow us to build more with less. And that's the bet we're making at RO. We are optimizing our company right now to be hopefully not decreasing our workforce. We need more people, but we're going to be trying to use technology to augment our existing workforce to be able to do more.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. All right, so we've got roughly 20 minutes left. So let's dive into Project Atlas. So So Project Atlas, you gave it a bit of description earlier, Todd, but it uses map data rather than traditional folder structure. So you could create digital maps of projects with plans, people, site photos, material, and drone imagery in detailed zoomable layers. Is that good? Was that a good?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, that really back to falling in love with the problem. The problem is we build in two dimensions, space and time, right? We got to put the Legos in the right place, in the right sequence. And that's how we build these projects. But we organize our information in an analog paper ruled world, which is we took the paper drawings and we digitized them, but we kept traditional folder structures and file cabinets just like they were in the analog form in the digital world. What Atlas was trying to challenge was, you don't have to live by paper rules in a digital world. What if we actually organize the information the way we build from the information? So if I'm standing on the 15th floor of a high rise, I shouldn't have to scroll past the landscape drawings, right? Yeah. Like in a digital world, I can have contextual abilities to build with context, to be able to know that, hey, I'm in this room. Well, show me just the RFIs that relate to this location. I don't need to go through all the RFIs. I just need to know it's situational awareness with construction.
So did you build the company to sell? Was that the plan?
No. Actually, the idea when I had it, it was when I was in operations. And it wasn't just, there were three of us that had been ideating around this idea. Joe Williams, myself, and Ben Bryngardner. Ben and I worked at Balfour Beatty together before I came to RO in 2012. And we were pushing digital documents across the organization. And there was a DFW airport was being built, and there were 75 floor plans for level one. I mean, this was a massive, like, I think it was either $6 or $8 billion project. It was massive. And we were like, this is crazy. We're flipping between area plans just to see the overall. So we were like, why can't you just zoom out like Google Maps? Mm-hmm. And zoom in. So that was where the idea first came. And I spoke on stage at the BIM forum and kind of just gave the idea to the industry. I mean, Autodesk was in the audience, Procore, Bluebeam, Trimble, they're all in the audience. And I literally said, I got video of it saying, y'all should go build this. Mm-hmm. And what was so interesting was the audience's reaction. And that's what made me realize I need to go do something about this. The first question I got, guys, was, well, how much does this cost? And I was like, no. You just watch some Photoshop videos. Like this isn't a real company. I work for a general contractor. This is just an idea. It was a session at the BIM forum that was facilitated by Rick Kahn and David Epps, two thought leaders in the industry that you should definitely talk to if you haven't yet. And both of those guys had reached out and said, Joe, Todd, I know that you always have some crazy cool ideas for the future of construction. We're hosting this future looking tech track. Come present something. So Joe and I were just saying, well, how about we do the Atlas presentation? But that's what's so funny, guys, is we didn't know that it was going to be like people in the audience were going to gravitate to it. We've presented plenty of our ideas before where they're like, oh, that's cool. But this one, the first question we got was like, yeah, how much does this cost? And we were like, no, this is just. And then the second was, do you have a booth? And we were like, no, we work for a general contractor. And then the third question was, well, when can I load my first project? And I remember driving down riding down the elevator, the lift with Joe saying, what was that? Like, what just happened? And we went and filed a provisional patent the next day.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
So how did it go with, so I guess Nemetschek acquired it. And can you run us through the process of, so you had a product and then there was some third parties who were interested in acquiring it, or how did it come to Nemetschek buying the product? Product Atlas.
Yeah. So it's so funny. Whenever, after Atlas got acquired, I get all these phone calls and emails from people across the industry like, what an overnight success. And thank you for laughing, because I was laughing. I was like, you don't know how many years this took. And that's what's so funny, is it takes years to make an overnight success. So if you're an entrepreneur listening right now, keep grinding. Yeah. Because you got to have the four P's of entrepreneurship. These are Todd's four P's: passion, persistence, perseverance, and patience. That last one is the number one reason I see entrepreneurs fail. They think they've tried it all and it didn't work, and they give up too early. And really, the light at the end of the tunnel was right there. So to answer your question, Martin, I mean, first we presented the idea. That was October 9th, 2014 at the BIM Forum. But we filed a provisional patent, but we didn't do anything with it. And then it wasn't until 2 years later, we went and raised some money, hired developers. And then within 20 months, just under 2 years after we built the solution, Autodesk and Bluebeam were interested in acquiring it. And it was funny. A lot of people are like, well, did you put them head to head? And I did. And I told Autodesk we weren't interested. We wanted to go with Bluebeam, just because when I started in the industry, I was a Bluebeam nerd. I was such a fanboy, and I was like, I gotta be true to my fanboy digital document days and go sell this to Bluebeam.
Brilliant.
And then, yeah, Nemechek, put us through the ringer with 6 months of due diligence, which they had like 275 different checklists. Wow. That we had to go through. Like, some would say, like, listing of all your real estate. We're like, we don't know real estate. We're smarter. Like, it was insane. So God bless anyone who goes through that, for sure.
First initial of your first pet.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I love
exactly.
The beef with Autodesk.
I don't want any Nemechek lawyers after this. So Nemechek was great.
Todd, how do you, curious, like, maybe some lessons you learned, and then also how you kind of go from that, like, burst of maybe probably adrenaline or excitement to then, yeah, like, the dust finally settling?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, whenever I started on the startup journey, a couple advisors that, and that's one advice I would say, is don't do it in a bubble. Don't do it in an ivory tower. Like there's other people that are willing to pay it forward and give you good mentorship and advisement. We had amazing advisors like Josh Kanner, who did Vela and sold to BIM 360 or Autodesk back in 2014. He was an advisor. Doug Chambers, who was CEO of FieldLens that got acquired by WeWork, he was an advisor to us. And Doug told me, he said, Todd, are you sure you want to do this? And I said, Doug, I got to scratch this itch. Yes, I want to. I come from a family of entrepreneurs. I want to try this. And he said, well, know this, you're going to sleep like a baby every night. And I was like, well, that's a weird thing to say. And he said, yeah, you're going to wake up crying every hour.
Yeah. I was going to say, my baby doesn't sleep through the night.
yeah, exactly. And you know, that's the thing, is it's not for the faint-hearted. I mean, I remember working my day job at RO when we entrepreneured this, and then nights and weekends I was working Atlas in the earliest days until we actually fully did Atlas. But I mean, there were nights where I was leaving the parking lot at 2 a.m. and then driving home 45 minutes and then coming back 3 hours later. So, I mean, insane. And I don't want to scare people, but I kind of do, because that's what it takes. You're not going to get around the hard work that's required to drive an idea across the finish line. I mean, we were so blessed to get acquired. You know, we had the option during the time when had Autodesk and Bluebeam talking to us. We actually had raised a Series A. We hadn't signed anything yet, but we'd raised about $3 million that was ready to close. And we had a very big decision to make of do we take this path or this path? And at the time, I think we chose the right path, in the sense of we saw this opportunity of being able to go partner with Bluebeam, a global technology leader, and bring this vision to life. Unfortunately, I don't think that was the full reason they were buying us. I think it was also we were competition, that happens. So just remember, too, as an entrepreneur, the moment you sell is the moment you hand over the steering wheel. Atlas, unfortunately, I don't think it's living anymore with inside Bluebeam. But I can tell you this, the vision is alive and well in many companies right now.
Yeah.
Procore just acquired Unearth last October. They were a competitor to Atlas. Of course, Autodesk is deeply partnered with Esri. So information by location and situational awareness, the vision is coming to life in our industry.
I just want to dig a little bit more into keep building versus selling and incentives associated with both options. So you were in talks with Autodesk and Bluebeam, Nemetschek, right? So I guess it's very difficult to imagine there will be another partner who is bigger than those, who could outbid those, right? Because there's probably no one that could have done it at that time. So those probably like a top of the bids that you could get, I guess, right? What was, on the other hand, you must have thought about not selling, but just keep building and seeing where this can go. I just want to get back to this time. And can you tell us, like, what were you thinking about if you stay within Project Atlas? How could the product develop, or where could you be?
I think I know what Martin was asking.
The decision to keep building versus selling.
Yeah, it was a tough decision. I mean, you know, as a creator, I wanted to, of course, keep building. But here's the decision that really moved us to sell was the idea was it, we knew if we kept building to build the company that would have the impact that we wanted to have on the industry would probably take about 8 to 10 years. Whereas we saw Bluebeam or an Autodesk as an accelerant to bringing the vision to life in 3, less than 5. So that was the reason why we sold. In hindsight, that's not what occurred. The vision didn't come to life in 3 years. So, you know, people could go, well, did you make the wrong decision? I don't live in any of like the regrets of past. I think everything's a lesson. And I think that, now we're going to see this vision of information by location come to life. I feel a little bit like the Vikings whenever they heard Christopher Columbus discovered the New World. I'm like, we knew about that.
Like 10 years ago now.
Yeah, but it built my family's dream home on our ranch in Texas, and we are so blessed. So and I actually, Martin, I never had Autodesk and Bluebeam compete. That's something else I will willingly let your listeners give me a lot of shit about. Forgive me too for cursing, right. But. We're in construction, right? So I guess that's something you'll learn about Todd is I'm driven by legacy and purpose more than a dollar.
Very nice. Okay. Last one, probably just from, so you went after the acquisition, you were working with Bluebeam as the VP of strategy and partnerships. What are these companies looking for when determining acquisition?
Yeah, so I can give you a very simple answer to that. What they're looking for is essentially a value add that they can plug into their existing capabilities and turn online as soon as possible. So the best advice I can give listeners that are wanting to create a company that is to be acquired by a Bluebeam, a Procore, an Autodesk, understand what their tech stack is and understand if your tech stack can complement, like if you're working, nerd out for a second, if you're building in JavaScript, are you in Angular or React, or do you have like a Node.js backend, or do you have like a mean stack versus, see what they have. Because if they see that you have a ton of technical debt, or, hey, we can't plug this into our existing platform easily, here's what they're evaluating. They're always evaluating, if we built it ourselves to release that value, how long would it take to get to the sale? And if you can show them a path that you can get them to a sale 6 months faster, just because you've built your company to be able to plug into their existing stack in a very easy way, then they will buy you.
Can you explain the term technical debt?
Yeah. So, for those that might not be familiar with that term, you know, whenever you're developing software, it's very similar to building a building, right? When we create foundation in a building, the level and quality of that foundation determines how vertical we can go. Like, if we build a building that is meant to be four stories and then the owner comes back and says, I want to build another story on top, it might not have been structurally engineered to do that. So for you builders listening, technical debt is that foundation in the code base that if it's not built in a scalable way, then the technology will be limited on the newer capabilities that can be added to it in the future. And that's why a lot of companies will actually go through a technical debt refresh internally, and all the customers are really upset going, you haven't released us any new features in the last 2 years. Well, no, it's because they're rebuilding their kitchen in the back, like, so they can serve you up some new recipes that are going to be real tasty. But the kitchen has to be rebuilt from time to time in software companies. And that's actually a good tip for you innovators that are listening. Don't just evaluate the solution that you're looking at, evaluate the people behind the solution, what their intentions are with the solution, and even understanding. I mean, if you ask them a question like, when are you going to go through your technical debt refresh? They're going to look at you like, how do you know? Because if they're going to go through that next year, you're not going to get any new features next year.
Very good. Okay, Todd, we have to wrap up. So any last closing statements? I'm sure you could speak to, like, for a good few hours about innovation. I can feel it.
And we will still enjoy it.
Well, thank you guys. No, I think first and foremost, thank you all so much for the honor to be here with you all. And I'm very passionate about being able to inspire younger builders that this is the most purposeful driven industry you could attach yourself to. I mean, we shape the geometry of everyone. Teachers, doctors, lawyers, the athletes we admire on TV, they live in the geometry of our creation. So I would say stay curious to your listeners. Be curious in everything. And even in something that you do over and over, look at it with a different mindset and say, what can I learn from this experience? Because that learning is where you're going to arrive at the discovery of a better way.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you, Todd.